Welcome to Soundbites on Domrava. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. A few weeks ago on the show, I spoke with historians Mike Lewis and Michael Twitty about the development of agriculture on Domrava during the colonial period. And today we continue our conversation with Mike Lewis, Director of Environmental Studies and Professor of History at Salisbury University, as we seek to understand how we arrived at our current system of farming. When and how did plantations and tobacco farms from John Smith's era become the poultry farms and large-scale feed operations that dominate our region today? I asked Mike Lewis to talk about major transformations during the past several hundred years of farming on Domrava.
There are several transition points that you can identify as you're trying to look back at what's going on in the agriculture on the shore. So one factor, of course, is what's going on with soil fertility and the way in which soil fertility shapes what can be grown prior to mass fertilizer use in the mid-18 to the 1900s. If you look at the tobacco, the reason tobacco is just not grown on the lower shore as much is in part connected with this. It just doesn't do as well here. The soil doesn't support it as well. Besides the soil fertility, a second key factor in what's grown and when it's grown has to do with transportation to markets. And so if you look at the lower shore, if you look again at some place like Salisbury, as the river starts to silt in, it's even harder to get your crops to market. There's just no way that anybody is going to be producing something like, for example, vegetable crops in Salisbury in 1820. They might have a small kitchen garden, but they're not going to be growing vegetables that are going to be shipped to an urban area. They just wouldn't ever get there before they would start to rot. They wouldn't be fresh. So when you start to have dredging of the rivers, which begins in the 1870s, and when you start to have the railroad come down the middle of Delmarva, which is in the 1860s and 70s, at that point you see a transition in what's grown simply based on how long it takes something to get to market. And so you're able to start growing crops that you can get to the market more quickly. So that makes a big shift in what is grown on the shore, and you start to see a lot more fruit and vegetable crops grown. Another factor that shapes what can be grown here and what is grown here has to do with competition from other areas. And so if you look at tomato production, for example, in 1958, the mechanical tomato harvester was perfected. Well, I don't know if it was perfected, but it was put into production. And this mechanical tomato harvester relied upon really, really large, evenly planted fields of tomatoes. And it was primarily used in California, Texas, and Florida. And the mechanical tomato harvester played a significant role in allowing large-scale tomato farms in those states to simply outcompete the smaller farms that were here on the shore, which relied upon human labor to pick their crops. Another factor which influences what was grown on the shore had to do with changing federal legislation concerning agriculture, the use of subsidies, and also the way in which the federal government tried to regulate the use of migrant labor that was passing through the shore and child labor.
What period are we talking about now?
1950s and 1960s is when you start to see some real transition there. If you look, Delmarva is so close to D.C., and in the 1950s and early 1960s, it became a big issue in D.C. what to do about migrant labor and child labor in America's farm fields. And because Delmarva was so close, I think it was particularly easy for journalists and fact-finding trips. They could just come across the bay. They could take a look at what was going on the shore. And if you go into the university library here and you look at the historical Washington Post and you type in Delmarva agriculture, you see a lot of articles in this period about migrant labor on the shore and about child labor on the shore. And so there started to be some pressure to change the way that migrant laborers on the shore were treated, to give them better living conditions, better wages. And there was also some pressure to stop the use of child labor. If you look during the strawberry picking season, for example, massive numbers of shore children would just not go to school for a few weeks while they would be out harvesting the fields. And so there started to be more attention paid by the government to trying to come up with fair labor laws and to also keep children in school.
I'm curious about what was the economic model that worked as agriculture grew? I mean, from the 1600s, I know it transformed. I mean, there had to be, who owned the land or who worked the land? How is it sold? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, you have now in the period, I guess I've read from the 40s to the or maybe from the 20s to the 60s, dairy was huge on the Eastern Shore in Delmarva, right? Am I correct about that?
Yep.
So talk about how those transformations happened. I mean, how did dairy get there? When did it begin? What came before that, and why did it dissipate and die?
When you look at the emergence of any of these different agricultural crop cycles here on Delmarva, it's linked to what they can sell and what they can make money on. And this is, I think, it's not too surprising. If you have something like milk, for example, and you have a railroad or you have a steamship and they can get milk to market, then it's very attractive to be able to sell this high-value product, as opposed to growing, for example, some grain, which is not going to bring you anything like the same rate of return. And when you have a high-value crop going into the urban markets from somewhere like Delmarva, you have to remember Delmarva is just beautifully situated, surrounded by large urban areas like Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington, D.C. Delmarva is just very well situated to get crops and to get products like dairy products to those markets pretty quickly at a very low transportation cost. And so when you look at the emergence of all of these perishable crops, I include dairy along with things like the strawberries and tomatoes and so on, they really start to emerge in the latter few decades of the 1800s with the emergence of first the railroad and then the refrigerated railroad car toward the end of the 1800s. This refrigerated railroad car, of course, made transportation of all of these perishable goods even easier. Now, the other side of that, the growth of urbanization and industrialization in America in the 1800s, the phenomenal growth of American cities, particularly in this period between 1880 and 1920. And that's when America becomes a more urban society. Hand in hand with the growth of the urban America was the growth of a high-output, productive agricultural economy in regions like Delmarva. Baltimore doesn't become Baltimore, and Philadelphia doesn't become Philadelphia without very productive peripheral agricultural areas that can feed them. Our urban areas simply can't exist without these peripheral agricultural regions, and that's what Delmarva has been. We have been a essential linchpin in the growth of urban America. The Eastern Seaboard, this entire urbanized seaboard from Washington to Boston, has in part been built on the food produced here.
So now I'm curious then, that's no longer the case in where
that's
we are
right.
Today. So before I go back to ask you about some economic models, I'm curious about how these things worked prior to the 1940s. What changed? How did it change? Why did it change?
So when you look at the changes then in the 1950s and 60s, the change is fairly quick and it's fairly dramatic. Salisbury was a, Wicomico County, Delmarva. It really moved rapidly from a very diverse production of many different vegetable and fruit crops and dairy to a much simpler agricultural system of producing in the fields primarily corn and soybeans and then just massive, massive amounts of poultry. This change was linked to several different factors, some of which I've mentioned before. One was the difficulty of competing with the growing massive industrial agriculture operations in places like California, Texas, and Florida. As you had easier transportation on a national level, you saw these other regions able to produce lots of vegetables, lots of fruits at very low cost, and it was no longer as economically profitable to grow those vegetable fruit crops here. Also, growing corn and soybean, farmers, when they do this, this is a much easier crop to harvest. It was an easier crop to plant, and it required less migrant labor. And so this switch to corn and soybeans was also an easier crop to deal with in the context of the fair labor laws and the increasing attention to the way, the treatment of migrant laborers on the shore. Then, of course, there's also the pull of poultry. And as is probably familiar to many of your listeners, the first mass production of chicken for a meat market was an accident on the shore. But as it occurred, it became a surprising opportunity for profit for many farmers here. They were able to grow lots of chickens, sell them to the large urban markets as a meat product, rather than before they had primarily had chickens as an egg laying activity. But they could sell these chickens and they could make a lot of money. As the chicken industry was really pioneered on Delmarva, and as you see the quick emergence of large poultry operations, this created also a demand for corn and soybeans. And so it's not that the corn and soybeans emerged in a vacuum, but it also became increasingly widespread on the shore, in part because of the demand for corn and soybean from the poultry producers. And so you had both the kind of increasing competition for the vegetable crops, which made those crops less profitable, combined with an increasing demand for corn and soybean.
So in many ways, it was the industrialization of farming outside of Maryland that led to some, as I understand the history, of the original Mr. Perdue, to say, okay, we have an opportunity here to build a new kind of industry. But it wouldn't have happened had the industrialization probably not taken place in California, where they can grow strawberries and all the fruits and vegetables we need and refrigerate them and sell them across the country.
Right. And of course, when you start talking about agriculture in California, the other side to that also is massive government investment in the agricultural infrastructure in California. When California grows tomatoes, they're growing them in basically a desert landscape, which is irrigated at great cost to the federal government through these large dams. Starting in the early 1900s, I believe it was 1902, we established a federal reclamation service. And their mission was to improve irrigation in the arid West to make it more suitable landscape for people to live, to grow crops. And so they built dams all through the West. And this story is very well told by Mark Reisner in Cadillac Desert. And they built these dams and they irrigated lots of agricultural land. And they never have made any of the farmers who have benefited from this irrigation pay the actual cost of the water that they get. So what happens is the taxpayers subsidize the creation of dams and then subsidize the delivery of water to farmers who were farming in basically a desert. The desert landscape is sunny. You get lots of good sunlight. You don't have many problems with fungus and mold because it's fairly dry. And then they irrigate. This means that tomato farmers in Salisbury, through the taxes that they paid to the federal government, were subsidizing the farmers in California who then could undersell them. And if you look at the farmers growing these vegetable crops in California, if they had been forced to pay the actual cost of the water that they were using to irrigate their crops, they could not have existed. They couldn't have sold their vegetable and fruit crops in an open market because it would have been so expensive. But because of the federal subsidy, they were then able to undercut the farmers in Salisbury. This is one of the great ironies. My students are always shocked by this. In Wicomico County, if ever there was a place on this earth that was well-suited to grow tomatoes, it's here. Tomatoes just do really well in Wicomico County. We get decent soil, and we get enough sun, and we get water that falls from the sky. Well, at least most weeks you do. I still have to water mine. But it's a great place to grow tomatoes. Yet we have set up this agricultural system where it's no longer economically profitable to grow tomatoes in Wicomico County, and instead tomatoes are grown in a place where they would never grow without us spending huge amounts of money to irrigate them and by basically converting the entire hydrology of the West.
So tomato farmers, truck farmers, these were mostly small independent farmers before the industrialization. These were what was the average size of a farm?
Boy, I couldn't tell you that number, but it was not big.
So it was 100 acres, 200, 300, 400, 600, less?
No. If you were talking about the lower shore, it would be probably the average farm would be less than 70 acres.
But these farmers made a living selling tomatoes and other vegetables to some supplier that would sell them other places.
That's right. There were farm markets in Salisbury and Laurel and all over the shore. You would have these farm auctions, and so the farmers would bring their crops to the farm auction, and they would then be sold to a merchant who would bid on them at auction, and then they would be loaded up on the trains and shipped up north.
And one of the things I've heard from a lot of farmers today, small farmers, is that system really doesn't exist. It's hard for farmers, unless they sell them to urban markets or if they sell them to individuals from their farm. Other than that, that system of distribution doesn't exist like it once did.
That's right. The Salisbury Farmers Market, or Farmers Auction, rather, it's been closed for a good while. And so it's much more difficult for a small farmer now to actually get their produce to market. And so Salisbury used to not only have the farmers auction here, but they also had a Campbell Soup Company, a canning soup factory in town, and there was a Green Giant plant here in town. So there, it wasn't just a matter of the farmers trying to figure out how to get their crops to Philadelphia. There was also a large local market for these crops by these industries that were then packaging the fruits and vegetables and then shipping the packages out to the urban markets. And these things are gone now.
And many of those businesses and those packaging companies and the canneries were on the Eastern Shore, were on Delmarva.
They absolutely were. And you had hundreds of canneries on the Eastern Shore even into the 1950s. And you had the first president of the National Frozen Foods Association was a Salisbury fellow who had been an important figure in the National Canneries Association. He was a guy who would spend time in D.C. He lobbied the federal government to help him start a frozen food operation here right at the end of World War II. And Salisbury was really, in many ways, the lower shore was a pioneering region for the production of frozen food, and it was, of course, it's now not even part of what goes on here. You see, ironically, there was the Kennerly Cannery, which is one which held on for a long while, and it was a seafood cannery, but then they also would can vegetables during the summer. But they got to the point where they were importing food to can in their cannery. Before they finally closed down. They were importing tuna from the Pacific, and they were importing other foods. It's just a bizarre switch from a kind of local economy in the 1950s in which there were so many thriving canneries that were producing locally canned food out of local vegetables and fruits to canneries that were closing down because there wasn't enough for them to do and where they were actually having to solicit products from elsewhere.
So that in turn, that's what kind of gave impetus to the local poultry industry. Talk a bit about that history and how that, from your perspective, how that exploded from the 40s till now.
Well, a few things are particularly interesting in looking at the explosion of the poultry industry. One is changing American patterns of diet, where we now eat much more meat than we would have eaten in the 1930s. If you look at the average meat consumption statistics, Americans just eat a lot more meat than we used to. And in part, this is because meat has been made more affordable through mass industrial production of that meat. And in part, it's also because we're eating a lot more chicken. If you look at the kind of statistics for how many chickens are produced here on Delmarva every year, it's just staggering. And this production of chicken has made possible a low-price meat, which is found all throughout American supermarkets. So when you look at the increase in poultry production, you have to tie it to increased American affluence after World War II, and also the kind of changing American assumptions that we should have meat every day, or many Americans now eat meat three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
If you look in the 1930s, I think it was the average American family would eat meat two or three times a week, and so it's very, very different from what it was at that time. The poultry industry, when you look at why was the poultry industry such a big deal on Delmarva, well, part of it is just chance. It was just the chance that you had the first farms who tried to experiment with mass production of meat poultry that just happened to be here. Beyond that, I'm told that this is a relatively good climate for poultry. It's also, again, you have the benefits of having the poultry close to large urban markets, so you have a demand center that's there. And you do have the poultry being produced close to regions that can supply it with its food. So the cost of production are much lower here than they would be if the poultry had started in some other region of the U.S. But nonetheless, I still have the sneaking suspicion that the success of poultry on the shore is something of a kind of historical accident. That had it started in some other region, it's very possible that poultry might not have ever been as prevalent on the shore as it is. And we see now that there are other regions of the country which are, of course, overtaking the shore as poultry-producing regions here in the U.S., and whether you're talking about regions in the southeast or Texas or elsewhere.
And when you mentioned, we talked a little earlier, I was curious that you talked about how subsidies built the or helped build the tomato and fruit industry in California and throughout the West, and also fueled the growth of the cities like Phoenix and L.A. and Las Vegas and other places like that. What role did that play in changing the nature of agriculture on Delmarva when it came to poultry, grain, soy, and the development of this new industry?
Sure, that's huge. If you look at the crops that are directly subsidized by the U.S. government, the big crops, the number one subsidized crop in the U.S. is corn. And we're not talking about table corn so much as we're talking about feed corn. And so through subsidizing feed corn, this has made it possible to more easily have all of the corn you need for all of the meat that we eat. The other crops that are subsidized at high levels, cotton is number two, soybeans are number three. So the corn and soybean complex here on the shore, which can be planted in rotation to try to maintain soil fertility, and the soybeans play an important role in chicken nutrition, they're both heavily subsidized by the U.S. government. The fourth crop is wheat, then tobacco, then dairy, then rice, then peanuts. These crops are the big ones. Corn, of course, in the last couple of years has benefited even more from the recent federal subsidy for ethanol, as you've seen the prices for corn just skyrocket. So whereas before, the corn subsidy often took the form of a price floor, guaranteeing that the price of corn was not going to drop below a certain point, you now see much more that the kind of government requirement that ethanol be used in gasoline has instead artificially inflated the price of corn, giving even more profit to the corn production here on Delmarva. I don't have exact numbers for what this ethanol subsidy has meant over the last 3 or 4 years, but it's huge. And I think that when they tally this up and they look at it on a national scale, it's going to be in the billions of dollars.
So coming back to something that you said your students said earlier, you know, when they said they go work on a farm, or some of them might go work on Ted Wycall's farm as internships, they think they're kind of harkening back to some pre-industrial age when agriculture was a family business and to feed local people. That's when you begin to talk to them about that never occurred. And what we're talking about now is on the verge of something very different.
It is. And I loved Little House on the Prairie when I grew up. I think some of my students have still seen it. That's a show that had some staying power.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, a lot of the students that I encounter in environmental studies, they want to live in the Little House on Delmarva. They imagine this sort of lifestyle. I've read the Little House on the Prairie books, and the goal of this family was to find a farm where they could start shipping grain to Chicago. And this is what the Little Houses on the Prairie were doing. They were converting the prairie landscape into a grain landscape following the train. They were shipping the grain on the train back to Chicago, making possible the growth of that urban area. In the same way on Delmarva, the Little Houses on Delmarva were engaged in trying to ship grain and then later ship vegetables and dairy products and now poultry to markets that can feed them. So when we talk about something like Ted's farm, Green Branch Farm, it's this notion of trying to produce food locally for a local market and to focus on that local market. That's really revolutionary. It's something that's quite different, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up with an entirely different model for understanding agricultural economies. Historically, Delmarva has been a production area. We have been a production area that produces food far, far in excess of what the people of Delmarva can eat. Right now, there's no earthly way, even with the population of Delmarva growing as rapidly as it has, still our population is not that high compared to the urban East Coast. There's no way we could eat all the chicken that's produced here. There's just no way. We couldn't eat all of the grains that are produced here. And so we've always served this role as a kind of production economy, producing more agricultural products than can be eaten here, and then it's being shipped out. The farms here have not been oriented toward trying to meet local market needs. They've been trying to meet the larger needs of the region and even beyond. So when Ted is looking at producing food for a local market, that's really a different way of thinking about what the role of agriculture is going to be in Delmarva. And there aren't that many farms on Delmarva that could subsist just producing food locally. There would be a right now we have more productive area growing food than we would need to meet local needs. So then we have to think, well, what is the local? You know, what is the local region that we should focus on? The converse of that, if all of the Delmarva farmers began producing food for local consumption, what would happen to Baltimore and Philadelphia, to Wilmington, to D.C., to regions which simply don't have the agricultural landscape right around them to produce as much food as they need? So we've gotten ourselves in this kind of interlocking system in which we have large populations of people dependent upon Delmarva food, and we will have to rethink where that food comes from, where it goes, and what our goals should be with that.
You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. Don't go away, because we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Wes Jackson is a Pew Scholar. In 1990, he was named a Pew Scholar in Conservation of the Environment. He's a MacArthur Genius Award winner. 1992, he won the Right Livelihood Award, founded the Land Institute, and is a very original and powerful thinker about how to transform agriculture in our world. And Wes, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
So, Wes, let's start by just you describing your theory and idea about, in some sense, as I read in another magazine, that our fall from grace of hurting this earth really started when we began to become farmers 10,000 years ago, and that's where it all began, and we're still living the result of that.
Right.
Could you explain? Well, go ahead.
Well, the human has been around with the big brain 150 to 200,000 years, and this is a lot of that evolution occurred during the Pleistocene, the ice ages. They went for about 1.8 million years, I guess. But at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, about 10,000 years ago, the ice has been receding. The planet's getting warmer, and it was freezing right over there. Probably out of the Zagros Mountains of western Iran, the wheat plant, an annual, that had big seeds, was picked up, and people started using that as a food. Now, of course, this weeds tend to grow in disturbed areas, and so in order to have fields of disturbance, why, that means you've got to disturb the ground, and in order to get a good seed bed and good germination. And so what was required of us at that moment is that nature is to be subdued or ignored in the interest of getting those calories. And my view is that that is the beginning of getting at non-renewable carbon. It was the carbon of the soil, and that would be the first pool, and the availability of that carbon then made civilization possible. So agriculture, I think, is perhaps where global warming began, because you're getting, it's been estimated that the United States had about 6% carbon. And with the opening of the continent, why, we went down around 3%. Now, part of that's due to the cutting of the forest. So I see the first pool to be the soil carbon, which is relatively diffuse carbon. And then the next pool is forests some 5,000 years ago, where we used the wood to smelt the ore to give us the Bronze Age and later the Iron Age. And then, of course, the biggie was 250 years ago with coal that made the Industrial Revolution possible. And then 1859 is Drake's oil well. And right after that, we started using also natural gas for power. So these five pools of energy-rich carbon that we've been through and going through has been a different experience for a gatherer and a hunter. All creatures go after energy-rich carbon because we're made of carbon ourselves, and that goes back, you know, what I call the 3.45 billion-year-old imperative. But that's why I've called agriculture the fall. I think that's what the myths we're really dealing with.
And your idea that you've been working on for the last 30, 40 years, right?
Yep.
It's creating what you ostensibly called natural systems agriculture.
Right. The idea is this, that those natural ecosystems that we destroy in the interest of putting in our annual grains. I mean, that first one was wheat, then it was rice over in Asia, and then corn or ZEA maize here in the Americas. That requires that natural ecosystems, which tend to feature perennials grown in mixtures, and those ecosystem processes that have evolved over billions of years, those get destroyed, greatly destroyed. And so the opportunity for nature's services to assist us in agriculture is greatly truncated. And we say, well, that's all right, we'll compensate. We'll compensate by adding nitrogen fertilizer, or we'll compensate by pulling the weeds or spraying the weeds. Natural ecosystems tend to avoid the epidemic that would wipe them out. And because with species diversity, you have chemical diversity. It takes a tremendous enzyme system on the part of an insect or a pathogen to give you the epidemic. So here you have a system that is resilient. It's a system that's, whether it's a rainforest or a prairie or an alpine meadow or desert scrub or whatever, those processes of the wild, so a huge percentage of those are denied in the annual monoculture. So the perennial polyculture was the original. The annual monoculture is what we put in that essentially overturned. It's about the opposite of what nature does generally.
So what would it mean if we went into a world and where agriculture was based on perennial systems of crops, of natural wheats or wheats that have been either hybrid wheats that come together, other kinds of grains and things? Tell us what that would look like. I mean, just how would it change the nature of how we farm and how we eat?
Well, it would be a dramatic change. For instance, what we're about at the Land Institute, we're mostly plant breeders here.
Mostly what?
Mostly plant breeders.
Uh-huh.
We're either making perennial grain crops out of wild species that we think show promise, or we're making hybrids between perennials and their annual relatives. For instance, we have crosses involving wheat and perennial relatives, sorghum and perennial relatives, sunflower and perennial relatives, and so on. And in other words, picking on those crops that represent about 70% of our calories and occupy about 70% of our acreage. So if we were to stop, though, with just the perennials and have only the monoculture, which would be even better than annuals in polyculture, but if we were to stop there, we miss a great opportunity. So to put them in mixtures that would mimic something of the vegetative structure, for instance, the prairie, then we now have a perennial polyculture that once you plant it, then what you have after that is harvest. And, of course, you're going to have to put back phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, and so on. Although, with biological nitrogen fixation, we could greatly reduce the energy costs of that, which is huge in agriculture. Then we've actually planted polycultures, actually of annuals, in order to, first of all, see what's involved in planting them. And we planted corn, sorghum, sunflowers, and soybeans. And
together, in one field.
Yeah, put them all together,
right,
just in a mix. And then with the combine, you just open up the concave, you cut the air so you don't blow the sunflower seeds out the back. We just harvest this instant granola, and mm-hmm. then you separate the seeds with a seed cleaner. So these are mechanical engineering kind of considerations. The agronomic considerations are the more challenging.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in other words, to get your mixtures that are just right or optimum for whatever place you might happen to be. I mean, for instance, if you are in a valley culture, you know, where soil, I mean, remember, our number one consideration is soil erosion.
Mm-hmm.
With the annuals, you're going to have soil erosion. The number two consideration is fossil fuel dependency. The number three consideration is the chemical contamination of the countryside and the water, the land and the water. So that's what we want to do. We want to move agriculture from an extractive economy to a renewable economy. So the with that as a goal, then to get the optimum kind of mixes involves what some would call agronomy. I prefer to call it a greater exercise of ecology. In other words, in fact, this may be something of a digression. I think it's worthy, though. The ecology, sitting on the shelf, out of that broad discipline mm-hmm. of ecology and evolutionary biology, accumulating, you know, for over a century. And especially since 1980, when the National Science Foundation started funding what they call the long-term ecological research sites. There are 26 of them around the country. Well, one of them in Puerto Rico. All right, so they have prairies, they have forests, so on, represented. Ecologists have been at work to understand the way these natural ecosystems work. They call them the LTERs. All right, now that knowledge has been huge. A lot of it just accumulated, but sitting there more or less for its own sake. Not all that much has been applied to agriculture because agriculture features those annuals and monoculture. But now we're saying with the perennials on the horizon, we can reach up there, dust that knowledge off, and begin to apply it. And that is the challenge that I think is makes it possible for us to imagine a sustainable green revolution.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I mean, so what we're talking about is if we could go perennial, and we'll talk about how long that would take in just a second. And what the essence of it is whatever crops you're growing, you design it after old natural systems with the perennials that have longer, deeper roots that stay in the earth. So you're just cutting the top, the plant itself, but the roots are there all the time. So
right.
So you don't have to plow the land over and over again every season to create your crops.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
So
that's right. In other words, it's the disturbance that then comes when you got the rains that come. And the stuff that we're made of then in this country goes down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, or out of the Central Valley of California into the Pacific. In other words, the ecological capital is lost. And so what we're arguing is that soil is as much of a non-renewable resource as oil, and more important than oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this deficit spending of the Earth's capital as a result of our dependence upon the annual grains, the grasses and the legume family primarily.
So what would it mean if this could happen, let's say in the place that you love, which you decided, as I read about you, Your daughter 30 years ago convinced you need to be in Kansas and not head of a new environmental studies department in California. So there you are. And how would that transform the state of Kansas if it could be a state of perennial agriculture, of a natural systems agriculture? What would
it
look like? What would happen?
Well, okay, let's go back a bit to 1854.
All right.
That's the ratification of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And Kansas was to come into the Union either as a free state or a slave state as a result of a vote. Well, Kansas, on January 29th, 1861, just 2 days ago, we had our 151st anniversary. So, you know, what was it like? Well, it was mostly at the eastern end, tallgrass prairie, and then in the mid-grass prairie, and then on out west where it's drier, short-grass prairie. So, you know, that's starting in 1854, 1861, then we have a civil war. But in 1862, there was a Homestead Act. And as a result of that, people were able to span out across this landscape. course of that period, the land-grant college system was showing farmers, helping farmers develop the annual grains, and Kansas became the wheat state. In fact, it used to be on our license plate, the wheat state.
Uh-huh.
So we plowed under the prairie roots and that diversity. And some said as they plowed under, it sounded like the opening of a zipper, opening and closing of a zipper. And that ecological capital that had been sustaining those prairies during all interglacial periods of the Pleistocene now began to erode. And so now here we have, imagine the opportunity to bring back perennial polycultures of grains in which we would essentially build domestic prairies. And I imagine we would manage them the same way those prairies were managed, with fire and grazing.
You said fire and grazing?
Fire and grazing.
Uh-huh.
You know, and rather than the bison, it would be the domestic bovine grazing our perennial polycultures. And we would also, they'd be grazing, you know, as a part of a management tool, but we, of course, would pull them off. Let's say maybe we'd have cattle on our perennial polyculture here at the end of January, but in a month or two, we would be pulling them off in order to get the growth that would then sponsor the seeds, because we then would go through the fields with our combines powered by a biofuel that may be the result of a harvest for fuel purposes. I think that biofuels ought to be restricted to agriculture. And we would harvest this instant granola and then separate the seeds with a seed.
And could we, from the way you see this natural agriculture growing, could we still feed America in the way we do now?
Well, my bet is that, first of all, we'll feed people longer because we will be saving the soil. That's one. Second of all, we're now saying that if you want high yields, it's going to take the perennial. Those perennial roots are elegant micromanagers of nutrients and water. Annual roots are poor managers of nutrients and water. And so we're saying now, withdraw the fossil fuel inputs and have an even playing field here. For sure, the perennials will yield the annuals. I also think, though we haven't proven this, but I think we are going to try that even with fossil fuel inputs, the perennials will outdo the annuals. You see, for one thing, those big root systems represent an investment in a system, and that's more or less once only. In other words, every year the annual has to put down roots. So it's using sunlight to putting down roots. Now, if those perennials are going to have slopping, there's going to be, you know, some slopping of the tissue that feeds the microbes and the invertebrates and so on of the soil. But we look at what has evolved really is the system, over millions of years that involves those root interactions. And the annual systems just don't have those opportunities. They're very good colonizers, but they're... As colonizers, they tend not to persist in something of a stabilizing environment.
Now, I heard that you said that, and I describe what this means, that to get to the threshold level of making this work, I suppose Lenin's do that would mean, would need $1.6 billion, which you say is a fraction of what we spend subsidizing ethanol. And
about a third, yeah.
Yeah, so... And how it could change things. Talk about what you would be doing with that. What would that mean?
Well, what we're imagining, what we're promoting, is this sustainable green revolution. We're promoting this to the foundation world, primarily. And we're saying, all right, in Asia, Africa, Latin America, we would like to see out across the landscape of the world, across the ecological mosaic of the planet, these principles of ecology to have an opportunity to operate with perennial species. Now, we're saying that this would mean the training, well, we say, of 110 PhD-level scientists that would be working in clusters we just say 11. There could be more places around the planet. Their goal would be to, this 30-year goal, to stay focused on this 30-year long term. They'd be working alongside people involved in the here and now. There will be a leakage of information between the two, but they're to stay fixed on that 30-year goal. Let the here and now people just keep on working with here and now. But then at the end of that 30 years, we're saying that enough, providing we've met all the mileposts that we've established along the way, there would be enough lift that we're way beyond what we might call the Kitty Hawk phase. We're far enough into it that the promise then is there, and there will be an increase in the imagination about various possibilities as we become more sophisticated at bringing what we've learned out of the way natural ecosystems work to inform that research agenda for annuals.
And you know,
perennials, I mean.
I'm sorry. Is this going on in any large way now here in the United States? Is anyone working on this natural systems agriculture actually working the land that way and providing food at this moment?
No, there are a few people that are working to develop perennial grains in various places. I mean, in Canada, at the University of Manitoba, in Australia, they're working on perennials. We're supporting the perennialization of the upland rice in China. And the good results were happening there, too, by the way. And then, we have colleagues at Texas A&M and University of Georgia, Andy Patterson with sorghum. We're perennial sorghum. So, but it's scattered around here and there, and it's finally getting a lot of attention. I mean, after all, there was an article in Scientific American. There's something in Science. There's something in Nature. There's been de facto endorsement by the Royal Society, National Science Foundation, National Resource Council. There's been, it's getting some visibility, but it far from what it was back in 1977, where it was considered totally crazy.
And you stuck with it anyway, which is a good thing.
Yeah, well.
in essence, this idea of going to perennials, creating a natural systems agriculture, rethinking the way we grow our food. We're doing this, you're doing this in the Land Institute, as someone wrote, a crash course is going to take like 30 years.
Yeah, right. But, when I said this, when I first published on this in 77, I said this is a 50 to 100-year plan. And, of course, people roll their eyes and think, that doesn't interest me much. Of course, the gathering hunting mind tends not to think beyond the next meal or the next year.
Right.
And so I wasn't particularly critical of people by being bored for wanting instant gratification. That's probably the way we're wired. Now it's interesting that we're not going to solve global warming in a short period of time. And we're not going to solve the population problem in a short period of time. Suddenly, what we're working on is a short-term solution.
And the idea that you actually look at this in the long haul. This is a long.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That's really a key important to think that way. I think.
Oh yeah, I think this is what our side has. What people've got to be thinking about now is that it's been this boredom-prone mind of ours is what has given us this much of the current problem. So but I think maybe there's a chance that a lot of young people I talk to on campuses. They're kind of stiffening themselves up and saying, okay, what do we need to do? And so I'm hopeful, and if you don't have hope, you have no basis for optimism. I'm hopeful because of some of the good conversations I've had, examples I've seen here and there.
Wes Jackson, this has been wonderful. I want to thank you so much, and it's been a great conversation.
All right, well, come see us.
Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered at Delmarva Public Radio by Christopher Rank. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For complete podcasts of our past episodes and information on how to contact us with your feedback and ideas for upcoming shows, please go to our website, www.ondelmarva.org. And for Public Radio Delmarva, I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Take care.